Welcome back to 20VC with me, Harry Stebbings, and I'm so excited for the show today. In many ways, this company's kind of pioneered their industry in their space, and I've been a huge admirer for a long time, and so I was thrilled to get this founder in the hot seat. And so with that, I'm thrilled to welcome Rafael Ilyashev, co-founder and co-CEO at GoPuff, one of the market leaders delivering daily essentials in minutes. GoPuff's latest funding round priced the company at a reported $8.9 billion in March 2021, and to date, Rafael's raised over $2.4 billion for the company from the likes of Excel, SoftBank, Fidelity, Baillie Gifford, D1, and more. And Rafael has scaled the company to over 550 US cities with over 7,000 employees nationwide. And I want to say a huge thank you to Jed at Headline and to Brian at Anthos for some fantastic question suggestions today. Really did make such a difference. But before we move into the show today, Mercury is building full stack banking for startups. Apply in under 10 minutes from anywhere for FDIC insured bank accounts, physical and virtual debit cards, domestic and international wires, in integrations with Gusto, Stripe, QuickBooks, Plaid, and basically every other tool your startup uses. They also offer unusual features like API access, custom team management, and their newly launched Mercury Treasury, a cash management product for high-growth startups. And they'll even help you build your startup with Mercury Raise, a program to connect you to Silicon Valley's top investors. Head to mercury.com/signup to apply. And speaking of full-stack banking there with Mercury, I have to say I just love using the AngelList fund admin platform to manage my investments. The team and platform at AngelList takes care of all my back office needs so that I can really focus on working with great founders. Leading fund managers have made over 10,000 investments into 6,000 startups using AngelList, all online and all in one place. And with the recently announced rolling funds, you can easily find and invest in these top fund managers on angellist.com/rolling. And finally, you have to check out Masterworks, the first platform for buying and selling shares, representing an investment in iconic artworks. Masterworks invite you to join an exclusive community investing in blue chip art so you can invest in multi-million dollar paintings, buy and sell shares on secondary markets, and then receive the proceeds when the painting sells. With more than $150 million in paintings purchased, Masterworks is the top buyer in the art market. So build your diversified portfolio of expertly vetted works curated by industry-leading research with Masterworks, and you can find out more at masterworks.io. But that is enough of my terrible accent, so now I'm thrilled to welcome Rafael Ilyashev, co-founder and co-CEO at GoPuff.
3, 2, 1, 0. You have now arrived at your destination.
Raf, this is such a joy to do. I've wanted to do this one for a long time, so thank you so much for joining me today.
For sure. Thanks for having me, man.
Not at all, but I do want to start, you know, we see the meteoric rise of GoPuff over the last few years. I want to go back to the beginning a little bit and set some context. So what was that aha founding moment for you with GoPuff?
You know, we were young, man. We were 19 years old when we thought of the business, Ekir and I. And essentially, Ekir was GoPuff 1.0. He was always driving us around everywhere. Ekir, can we get snacks? Ekir, can we get drinks? What can we do to kind of make sure we can utilize Ekir in all aspects of our lives? Because he's the only guy with the car. And we realized that there's two pretty big problems. Stores were not so convenient. On-demand delivery services were on-demand. And Ekir is not very scalable. So we thought about, how do we rethink this problem? How do we redo it? And the initial idea was very different than what else was out there, right? We said, instead of partnering with folks and kind of creating this third-party marketplace, the only way to effectively solve this problem for both consumers, which is first and foremost, and then ultimately unit economics, is by vertically integrating. So owning the entire experience end-to-end, owning the micro-fulfillment centers, the inventory, and everything in between. And Harry, I got to tell you, in 2013, that wasn't a very beloved idea.
I'm sure it wasn't a very beloved idea. I mean, firstly, can I ask, what does that do to your funding requirements and your margin structure when you want to own like end-to-end the vertical solution?
Yeah, so we had a very unorthodox kind of upbringing, especially kind of being a US-based startup. We didn't raise money for our first 2.5 years. Day one, the business was producing EBITDA. It was profitable from day one. And it's because our gross margin structure, even back then, it's improved significantly over the years. Even back then, was far superior than everyone else. So we were able to produce positive contribution margin ultimately from day one. And we used that profit to expand to a number of our first cities, right? Philadelphia helped fuel Boston's growth, which then helped fuel Washington, D.C.'s growth. We then, for one reason or another, decided to go to Texas. And we opened up Austin as city number 4. And only as we were approaching the 5th and 6th city did we raise our first round, right? So it took a lot longer, obviously, to open up markets because there was no external cash. But the foundation of the business and the underlying unit economics supported profitable growth from day one. So we didn't even need to raise money in the beginning. The reason why we raised money in 2015 and beyond is to accelerate that growth, accelerate both micro fulfillment center openings and new category launches.
Can I also, on the margin structure, I'm just fascinated because this is like traditionally in an industry that's like blighted in the UK, say by 5 or 6% on convenience store goods. How did you have that superior margin structure so early?
So when you vertically integrate and you own the goods, your blended gross margin is significantly higher, obviously, than when you partner with folks, right? So when we started this business, the blended gross margin was in the high 30s, right? It's now in the high 40s and growing. And the contribution margin is double digit positive. So ultimately, by owning the goods and having in our fulfillment centers, we're able to buy these things. And obviously, as the business grew, so did our buying power and our ability to vertically integrate even more to kind of larger FCs and buy directly from manufacturers kind of led to really, really superior unit economics. And I'll tell you kind of one step further. It was really important for us to nail the business model before scaling it. It was really important to figure out how are the unit economics going to work? How are we going to produce a profit before we started taking out external cash? So that's exactly what we did. Obviously, we maybe waited even a little too long, right? 2.5 years, but we believed it was the right thing to do for the business.
Can I ask, looking back, and I know hindsight's always, you know, challenging and probably futile and useless, but I am interested. Do you wish you'd raised cash sooner and been more aggressive on those expansion plans sooner?
And I kind of go back and forth there. It gave us like a lot of really strong discipline. Kira and I literally lived in the warehouse our first year, right? We were the drivers and we've had to figure out the supply chain and logistics. We didn't have the hires. We were doing everything. And I think that brought on a really great deal of discipline and a lot of empathy to a lot of the folks that are actually doing all the deliveries, packing all the orders, everything else, right? We literally, it was our home. The other side of the equation was like the business would probably have been a lot larger today, right? We've been able to scale triple digits year over year for the last 8 years consistently. But we would probably be even larger today, right? We raise money and can fuel growth a lot earlier, right? And basically that fuel of growth is not really marketing growth, but infrastructure growth, being able to open up more buildings faster. So that's probably the trade-off on both sides. But as you said, hindsight 2020, I'm really, really happy where we are today.
I mean, what a terrible question. Jesus, I'm amazed that I got this job. But I do have to ask, you know, you mentioned the expansion in terms of the cities that you opened up. A big one for me is always, what are the characteristics that make a city attractive for you to expand into? I know obviously you've got now plans for Europe, but when you think about we want to move to this new market, what drives that decision making?
You know, Harry, now we have a full market development team. There's a lot of insights that go into how and when and what parts of the cities we go in first and how do we expand afterwards. The first version of GoPuff is just go where the customers are, right? If people were going onto GoPuff, requesting GoPuff and not able to order, you know, getting onto the app and saying, hey, we're not in your delivery zone. And there was a large pocket of those people. That was the expansion strategy. It was very, very simple. Go where the customers are. And that served us well for like the first 3-4 years. It worked really, really well. It's like a very simple go where the customers are strategy, right? We look at a lot more traffic patterns, density, so weather, like we look at a lot of things today and a lot of inputs, but still one of the most important inputs is a metric we call intent to purchase. So folks that are getting onto the platform, trying to order GoPuff and then cannot order GoPuff. Is the reason why we're opening up a micro fulfillment center nearly every single day. We're opening up 30 of these a month and accelerating even more, but it's not the funnest thing to do, right? To open up that much infrastructure, but it's the right thing to do ultimately for the business. And we're going to continue to accelerate on that part of the business as well.
Can I ask, I'm fascinated. I had Simon Barrera on the show from Rappi. And he spoke about what it took to spun up new markets for Rappi in Latin America. When you think about like spinning up new markets, what does it take to get to break even and profitability in new markets? What does that resource allocation look like in new markets? Can you help me think through that?
So we look at comp markets as markets that are 18 months or older. Today, here's what gives us all kind of clarity and confidence in the world to invest in hundreds and hundreds of buildings every single year is 100% of our comp markets that are profitable. They're producing cash flow. It kind of gives us everything that we need to continue to press on the accelerator. And that's been a consistent kind of year over year. What's even better is our path to profitability is increasing even faster. So even though 100% of our comp markets are profitable today, on aggregate, the unit economics as a whole are profitable. We're producing positive contribution margin on an aggregate basis, including the markets that are kind of negative from a cash flow perspective because they're just too young. So the reality is we have all the levers in this business, right? Like a lot of people talk about this business or our business can be profitable in 2024 or 2025, in theory, we were profitable for our first couple of years of existence, right? And the reality is we have all the levers we need to go back to EBITDA whenever we want. Just right now, it's a massive growth opportunity. Customers are telling us that they want more and more GoPuff. They want GoPuff even faster. So we're really pressing on the accelerator lever right now, but keeping a close eye on unit economics, and the story is just getting better, right? We're getting profitable faster, and 100% of all of our comp markets are profitable today.
What makes a zone get profitable faster? What does that market maturity look like for you?
Yeah, we call it like the fortification strategy, right? Or fortress. The more you fortress a given market, so add more micro-fulfillment centers in a given city, the faster that specific micro-fulfillment center will get profitable. Obviously, right, there's already brand awareness and everything in that city. But two, deliveries actually get faster, right? You're reducing the drive time. Right? There's a lot of things that you could do on the technology side, right? You can build the best binning and batching algorithm in the world, right? You can improve pick and pack time in the buildings. You can improve routing. You cannot reduce the amount of time it takes to drive from point A to point B, right? It's just the reality of the situation. So you have to get closer to the customer. So we've been spending a lot of time on this fortressing strategy where we're adding more and more micro-fulfillment centers within our given cities. And as a byproduct of that, those cities are getting profitable even faster. And it's great for the customer, right? You're reducing average delivery times significantly. We're hoping to get average delivery times to 15 minutes, roughly, this time next year on an aggregate basis. It's really easy to deliver 10 or 15 minute deliveries when you're like kind of subscale. When you're delivering kind of millions and millions of orders a month, it's a lot harder to do it consistently, but we're really, really confident we could go from like low 20s where we're at now to mid-teens in a matter of quarters.
It's really interesting. I saw a tweet the other day about, it was about the negative network effects of DoorDash, whereby almost the more popular they become, they suddenly have multi-deliveries, and so the wait time becomes longer because it's not just like a driver's delivering one, they're delivering three, and so you're waiting longer. How do you think about that? And how do you think about that negative network effect? Is there one when it's almost more popular?
When you vertically integrate, you have a single pickup point. So binning and batching is a lot easier of an equation than multiple pickup points. So, you know, not talking about other models, but when you look at our model, there's an industry metric called ODH, the amount of orders a driver can fulfill an hour. The higher the ODH, the more efficient that driver is, the traditionally the worse the delivery time. The reality is that once you get enough scale in a market, ODH and your kind of delivery experience become kind of hand in hand because the volume of orders that are coming from the same square block kind of increases exponentially as the more and more popular the service becomes. So while there's an initial trade-off why markets are generally unprofitable for the first couple of months, because you don't have enough density, once you really get the density in place and you can start really pulling on that ODH lever, you can deliver things incredibly fast, 12, 13, 14 minutes, and still deliver two or three orders in a batch.
What's good ODH to you? What's the target and what does it take to get there?
It's a market-by-market approach. We're well over like four and a half ODH in some of our more established markets, kind of industry leading, right? And the key is that you can pull levers, right? You can have 35 minute deliveries and like a six ODH, but you're profitable well below that. Right? You're probably well below 4 ODH. I think for us, we're really eyeing on the side of delivering a really spectacular customer experience and just really surprising and delighting the customer. And we could still do that by delivering really, really superb unit economics.
Can I ask, and sorry if this is a controversial one, but in terms of like the unit economics being so good, as you mentioned, when you have increased marketing costs, like Bunny, we both know the space is getting more and more competitive and we're fighting for the consumer more and more. And we're going to see CACs go up traditionally. It's just how the game works. How do you think about that and the impact of CACs increasing, impacting unit econ?
You know, we always said the best marketing is operations. If you deliver an incredible experience to customers, your customers will bring more customers. It's why it's a quarter, I think it's going to grow to 30% of customers this year come from in-app referral. So folks that are getting onto the platform, it's extremely cost-effective, right? It's the lowest CAC you can get, right, outside of organic is kind of in-app referral. And that channel is growing as a percentage of our new customers because we're just getting better and better at delivering a really phenomenal experience and increasing GoPuff's use case. There's no secret, right? This business started as a college delivery service. College, while it's an important part of our business, is in the low teens as a total percentage of our customers. And we've dramatically expanded the use case of what makes GoPuff so special, right? We introduced alcohol, introduced pet and baby, over-the-counter medication, household. And we're going to continue to press on the innovation lever on introducing more and more products that are really, really important for our customers, right? We call it like this infant needs category, delivering anything that anyone needs very, very fast. And while we only have relative, right, we have 4,500 SKUs per micro fulfillment center, we don't have the massive tail that a traditional big box has, right? So we're not everything for everyone, but we'll have the smart selection to items that people need each and every day. And the combination of that plus delivering a really phenomenal, super fast, consistent experience, because like it's really easy to deliver one fast order It's a lot harder to consistently deliver that fast order every single time someone orders. The combination of the consistent super speedy order plus smart selection, right? This instant needs category, it's what's making this platform so much more sticky, and it's what's driving the referral engine to really roar in a way that surpassed all of our expectations, right? We thought referral is going to be like a 15-20% kind of new customer engine. I think that's going to be closer to 30% this year.
It's so interesting you said there about the referrals, because, you know, Investor for My Sins today, and I speak to a lot of other investors in Europe, and they often challenge the model and say, not obviously GoPuff, but in Europe, and say, ah, there's zero consumer loyalty and there's zero brand loyalty because we're delivering commodity goods. I'm not sure I agree with that, bluntly, but how do you think about, like, consumer loyalty and brand loyalty, especially on the consumer side?
Yeah, I think it's important to really listen to what your customers want. I think a lot of founders have these preconceived notions that, like, I know what the customer wants, so I'm going to do exactly what the customer wants, and instead kind of really listening and understanding what the customer's needs are, right? And there's two things that we hear really consistently that the customers really, really love, right? They love a fast, consistent experience, and they want to get more products from our service. So, like, as we enter into new categories, right, because we're vertically integrated, we can test and launch products extremely fast. So one of the really, really important initiatives was local, right? And like local is an extremely strong lever for stickiness to customers. We started with a local donut shop in Philadelphia during the pandemic that was not doing so well. It closed its doors. It was a phenomenal success. Over the course of the last two quarters, we introduced 600 other local products throughout the ecosystem, right? The goal, I think we're going to introduce like 2,500 this year on local products across the entire infrastructure. Not because we think local is important, right? And it is, right? You're helping the community, but even more so, it's something that customers really, really love. So we're really taking a deep listening approach to our customers and what's important for them. And as a byproduct, it's leading to some of the best customer retention and stickiness of customers. I'll say, like, your subscription program is very, very important as well. Your subscription customers behave in a way that is very different than your non-subscription customers, right? Like 30% more repeat on a monthly basis, significantly higher AOV, even though that you remove the delivery fees from your subscription members, they're ordering more. So not only are the baskets larger, they're ordering more frequently. So it's important to kind of get people within your loyalty program, but even more important, right? People need a reason to try the product. And once they try, they're really hooked. So the most important thing is to make sure that you give people a chance to try. And the best way to do it is by expanding the scope on the things that are most important for your customers. So like our first holy grail was alcohol. And then I never thought, you know, in 2013, we'd be an authority in the baby category. But here we are, right? Something that's really, really important to our customers and our single largest growing category kind of from a year over year basis. So we're really, really focused on the moments that matter most for our customers.
Can I ask, how do you think about paid product promotion? When you think about, say, baby goods, you know, you've got Unilever, you've got P&G. I don't have children, so I've run out of names already of, you know, baby good providers, but I'm sure there's many. And I'm sure they want to be number one on GoPuff's discovery. How do you think about paid product promotion? Because, you know, when you look at Amazon today, that paid search is a huge business for them. How do you think about that? And what are the internal discussions on that?
You know, we created a group a few years ago called GoPuff Marketing Solutions for this exact need, right? Again, we have our consumer products and then our CPG partners are our customers as well. And they were telling us about a breadth of features that they would love to see on GoPuff. So we said, how do we productize this whole thing? So we created product teams. We hired really, really great leaders to run the GoPuff Marketing Solutions business and built a number of products that were really, really important for our customers. We actually just launched our self-service platform where brands can go on and create campaigns themselves and obviously more intricate and more detailed campaigns. We still have someone internally on the GoPuff side helping, but whether it's shelf space, product placement, sampling, we created some really, really amazing tech for our CPG partners to use and ultimately not just grow their share on GoPuff, but grow their share nationally and regionally in the places that are really important for them as well. It's a place that we're investing a whole bunch of dollars, right? And the bulk of it is happening through kind of product innovation and really making sure we're listening to our CPG partners and then innovating ultimately in that regard as well. So really, really great relationships with kind of Unilever's, P&G's, Mars, Nestle's of the world. But we're also working with a lot of the local players that have like a $1 million budget, right? Instead of, you know, a multi-billion dollar budget that said, hey, I'm not big nationally, but I'm an authority in Dallas, Texas. How do I grow my business here? So it's really important to kind of pull both of those levers.
Can I ask, we spoke about locations earlier. In terms of like expansion plans, we chatted a little bit before the recording about actually the move to London and Europe and like an increasing focus on Europe. Why did you decide now was the right time? And how did you think about this expansion into Europe?
I talked about like nailing the business before scaling the business, right? And I think we had all the chances in the world to expand to Europe 2 years ago or 3 years ago or even last year. And it was important for us to really make sure that we had a really strong grasp in the US and can expand after that. So after we acquired BevMo in California, we kind of had a total grasp of the California market. I don't remember exactly, 60 or 65% of California's total population is within an 11-minute drive of a BevMo. So it really gave us the network we needed in California. We're launching in New York in an extremely aggressive way this summer. We're going to have very, very fast deliveries, not just in the island of Manhattan, but all the boroughs. So we have a pretty good grasp in the US. We're not going to stop expanding in the US. We're actually going to open the tune of 400 buildings in the US just this year. But we feel we have all the operational firepower and the technological firepower to take over Europe as well. So we'll be investing hundreds of millions of dollars in the European market. We actually already started with our acquisition of Fancy in the UK, but we're really just getting started. So we're going to expand to a number of countries and be really, really aggressive there. But again, just following the customer, following what the customer wants. You know, there's a lot of players that have been around for about 3 or 4 days all over Europe saying we're the GoPuff of the country that they're from. And it's important, I think, to remind people there's one GoPuff, right? And we want to make sure we continue to expand to that country and give the customers what they want.
Can I also, what actually happens with the space? Is it like a consolidatory environment where there's one or two massive players and it's an acquisitive environment? Is it they die a painful death? How does it play out in your mind?
Yeah, I think up until like 2 years ago or maybe even 18 months ago, the idea still of vertical integration was like a scary thought. They're like, oh, there's just one player in the US. Yeah, they're kind of scaling and owning the US. You can't really expand that globally. Doesn't make sense. You need a third party model. And I think the more time passed, the more people realize that if you don't own and you don't vertically integrate, it's very tough to control the consumer experience totally. And it's really tough to make money. So everyone is realizing that this is the model to expand to. The reality is it's an extremely complicated, very, very difficult to scale business. One of the easiest things is to actually open to buildings, right? Like get them open. But all the technology takes the power to inside of these buildings, right? It took us years to build.
Can I dig in on that? What is so challenging? Is it the pick and pack? Is it the SKU selection? Like what's the challenging elements there?
Let's start, like we built our entire WMS from scratch, our entire warehouse management software. That's 99% of the time, right? You buy off the shelf, right? There's nothing available off the shelf to fix this solution. We had to build entirely from scratch from the moment that a product is open for ordered from a distributor or coming from our own larger fulfillment center to when it hit the dock of the micro fulfillment center, what receive and stowaway looks like, random stow inside our facilities. I'm not going to go too deep into how the inside of the four walls operate. And then to pick and pack, ultimately bin and batch and then route. All of that is entirely proprietary and built in-house and took years to develop. And by no means are we done, right? This is going to take years and years and more duration to get better and more efficient, right? We're listening to our drivers on what's happening on the GoDrive world. GoDrive is our driver application that all of our driver partners use and the innovation that's happening there. But this is not an easy problem to solve. And by no means have we solved it completely, right? We have a long way to go. But to imagine that this could be solved in a year or 6 months is crazy. We're 8 years in the making with hundreds and hundreds of engineers, and we're just getting started.
And after 8 years of grueling growth, you still look incredibly young, Raphael. So don't worry, it's totally fine. Can I also, you mentioned the incredible growth plans coming. In terms of like retaining profitability and that kind of unit economic mindset, are you concerned slash worried with aggressive expansion plans comes a reduction in unit economics and a reduction in profitability inherent within that kind of lever model?
Yeah, I think it's important, Harry, to understand how Kira and I grew up. Kira and I grew up in like this first generation immigrant, small business parents kind of upbringing, right? We didn't really have much of a early childhood, right? All of our childhood for myself and Kira, all we can remember is working, right? Working with our parents, delivering everything they can for a customer and building a profitable business because that was just the way that our parents survived and gave us a better life in America. I think for us, we treat this business the same way, right? Like the most important thing is the customer, right? We do everything that it takes for the customer. That shouldn't contradict an ability to build a profitable, sustainable, long-term business. So I think for us, and I'll never say we never kind of made an investment into decreasing unit economics for growth, but we'll never do it in a way that makes the aggregate or the comp markets unprofitable. Never is that black and white. I usually don't like to kind of have black and white approaches to these kind of things. But you know, I think what's important to understand is like we have a really, really strong balance between hypergrowth and sustainable growth. And usually it's very tough for a business to have that balance. And quite frankly, it was tough in the early years. You know, in year eight, it's become a lot easier because you have so many markets that have been established for so many years that are just producing massive amount of cash flow. So our scale and the fact that we've been around for so long has really helped us kind of be able to continue to make pretty aggressive investment.
You mentioned starting the business when you were 19 and going through that incredible scaling process, building GoPuff into what it is today, you've got to scale with the company. What's been the most challenging elements for you in terms of scaling your leadership alongside such fast company scaling? Because that's hard.
Yeah. I mean, the number one thing is humility, right? Leaving your ego at the door and realizing like you know so little compared to what it needs to take to kind of build a business like this. And I'll tell you, we're really, really fortunate, right? Over the years, we had a number of coaches that have come in and helped. So like if the business is 3Xing year over year, Kira and I need a 10X year over year. If we don't do that, then we're really screwed. We're in a position where the business won't be able to scale because Kira and I are not able to scale. And we're fortunate to have really, really great people around us. Really amazing folks that have come and joined the team and believed in this crazy vision and took a massive bet. And Kira and I started with a lot of humility, right? Really understanding that you don't know so much and you have to learn, but you have to learn fast and you have to outpace the business's growth, right? So if you're just on par with how fast the business is growing and how you're developing, it's a disaster. So it's really just surrounding yourself with the best outside talent, right? Your coaches that are helping you scale mentally and think through problems and avoid landmines, and internally bringing the best talent from all over the world to run all different aspects of your business.
Can I ask one final one? You mentioned that kind of the external perspectives. You know, I spoke to Jeff at eVentures Now Headline, and he said about the prominence of a particular statement for you and for the business, which was making moves. Tell me, what does like making moves mean to you? And how do you think about kind of velocity and speed in everything that you do?
Making moves is like an early rally cry that we had, right? It's like just a bias for action, right? Instead of focusing on all the problems, and there were many, right? And there still are, being really solution oriented and focusing on fixing those problems. Something that's just really important in the business that seems pretty simple, right? Like you're delivering things from point A to point B, but is extremely complicated at scale. So we kind of now call it make strategic moves, right? Make moves that make sense for a lot of scale, but especially really early on. And now, quite frankly, there needed to be a bias for action. There needed to be, how do we really, again, go back to nailing this business model, nailing the unit economics, and then ultimately scaling and scaling very fast after we got it right. So a lot of our folks that have joined a team from all kind of walks of life have this innate thought within them is like, we need to figure out how to move and move faster than anyone else. The thing that was going to ultimately cause us to fail so early is that we got to out-execute. And even today, we have this mindset that we have to out-execute everyone in our way. We strategically figured out so many things in this business, right? How to scale infrastructure. How do we scale the regulatory environment within the US and globally? How do we figure out the technology to power these things, operational excellence, the supply chain and logistics portion of this business to get the items to the micro-fulfillment centers. It's now just really out-executing everyone in our way.
Can I ask one final one? It's again, Jet told me that, you know, fundraising in the early days, a lot of VCs didn't also understand the full vertical integration style and approach, and there were quite a lot of no's. It's always shit and hard to take no's. How do you think about the persistence and grit, and how did it feel, and how did you get through the early no's as a founder and as a leader?
You learned that generally humans operate on pattern recognition. And we're talking about 2013, we launched this business. 2015, we started raising money. The pattern recognition at the time was, we are not Uber or Airbnb's model. So that means this is not going to work. Right? What do you mean you're going to own inventory? You're going to have hard assets on your balance? This doesn't make sense, right? You're never going to be able to scale. You're never going to be able to open up more than 20 or 25 or 30 buildings a year. And I think we just took it as a lesson. We took all the feedback that people got as a lesson. And we had investors on board that were bold and visionary enough to say, like, that model that people have scaled with right now might be a good model in the industry, or in some regards, maybe it's not even a good model in that industry that they're expanding in. But for delivery specifically, this is probably the model that's going to win, right? Because it's the model that makes, yes, it's harder to scale. Yes, it's harder to figure out the technology. Yes, you have so many more complexities, but it's ultimately the right thing for the customer. And it's ultimately the right thing for unit economics. And I just believe the businesses that are most customer obsessed, right? If Amazon's taught us anything, right? It's that are the businesses that are going to win. And this is the model that most customers says, so Jet took a bet on us in the Series B. Aller took a bet on us in the Series C. And as a byproduct, as you know, the business started developing more and more, it started becoming more and more evident this model is going to win. So like by the time we got got to 2019, a whole bunch of people, right, are really interested in the business and love kind of the scale. That was not really the case in 2015, 2016, where vertical integration was just a scary thought and idea.
Isn't it nicer when the world suddenly sees it through your eyes?
Yeah, but a lot of learnings. Listen, I'm not like, by nature, I'm not, Yikir and I, both of us, we're not like grudgy people, right? We learned through all of this. We established learnings from every experience and ultimately, I think, became better leaders as a byproduct.
But I do want to dive into a quick fire round now. So I say a short statement, Raf, and then you hit me with your immediate thoughts. Does that work for you?
Sure, let's do it.
Okay, so what's the favorite book and why? What's the must read?
I love Trillion Dollar Coach about Bill Campbell. It's just kind of a reminder for everyone that, you know, you need a rock star coach to build something truly generational. And I think Bill Campbell was that for so many folks. You know, we were fortunate enough to have some of those as well.
If you were to choose one thing above any else that drove the success of GoPuff, what would it be?
It's probably like persistence. It's like, it's so easy to give up. It's so easy to just like, be like, why am I still living in a warehouse? Why am I, you know, why am I still doing this? But, you know, 8 years in, we're still 15 hours a day, 7 days a week, right? Persistence, I think a huge unlock in building something really, really great, along with humility and everything else. But I think that's definitely a trait that's high up there.
I have to ask this one. It's not on the schedule, but you mentioned your parents and kind of working and learning from them in the early days. What was like the biggest takeaway from working so young, seeing them operate as small business owners? What was the biggest takeaway?
It's kind of the other thing I mentioned. It's humility. My parents and Yikir's parents, why we were best friends and we worked so well together, like raised in different parts, not knowing each other until college, but like almost an identical upbringing, right? It's kind of even strange how that worked out. You know, this humility portion of, you know, sitting down, be humble, learning, listening to your customers, doing whatever it takes for them, was ingrained to me like at age 10. You know, it kind of shoved into my brain, hey, you know, you better do whatever it takes for them because they can ultimately shut down this business by just choosing not to come here, by choosing, you know, to go somewhere else and doing something else with their business. And, you know, my mom specifically even really, really drilling that into me. I think it made me a better human for it, right? Not just in business, but as a human being itself.
Penultimate one, I heard about the incredible CTO hire that you made pretty early. What's the key to successful hiring? Maybe getting talent way ahead of the company scale.
We call it like a team-oriented super athlete on anyone that's joining the org, especially in our leadership team, right? And the super athlete trait is like table stakes, right? If you're not the best at what you do, triple-digit year-over-year growth, especially a consistent one, probably not the right environment for you. But this team-oriented trait is actually even more important, right? It's when we're deciding between candidates, that's a tiebreaker, especially, right? It's a 51-49 split. If you're not making everyone around you the best version of themselves, like kind of elevating the overall average, it's not going to move the needle far enough. So we're kind of looking at talent through that kind of lens, through that team-oriented super. It's how we developed our core values and everything else. But it just starts getting people that are just slightly crazy, right? Like, you know, it takes a lot for someone to go through a very established, a very large environment. I'll give you an example. A few months ago, we hired Tim Collins. He's the former head of global operations at Amazon, one of the best operators on the planet. And it goes a lot to go from, hey, 23 years at Amazon, building something incredible kind of all over the world, right? Launching Europe and Asia and everything else, to I'm going to go back to like a lot of craziness and a lot of really hyper growth. And it really depends on the human being, right? Trying to put a circle into a square peg, just it doesn't work. So make sure the values of the human are right, and then kind of sales and everything else goes into place. If you're just kind of going off resume and tenure and everything else, and four or five values align, or three out of five values align, it's a recipe for disaster, right? Probably not going to work out. To hire that person, definitely not going to work out long term.
Final one. What do the next 5 years hold for you and for GoPuff? Like, just how big could this be?
No, Harry, this is like a generational opportunity for us. We were saying that in 2013, we had, I think, all the opportunities in the world to exit this business along the years. It's not even something that we frankly entertained or considered. Our TAM globally is massive, right? It's over 10 trillion right now and growing. Right, we're expanding into multiple categories. That's not only great for the customer, but also increasing our TAM exponentially. And I think this business over the next 5 years is a multi-hundred-billion-dollar business. And got a long way to go and a lot to build, but we're really pressing on the accelerator and moving in a very aggressive fashion as a byproduct.
Raf, listen, I've absolutely loved this. I can't thank you enough for doing it. And I can't wait to welcome you to Europe. So let me know when you're here and really appreciate the time today.
Yeah, we'll grab a pint in London. It'll be great.
I absolutely love that discussion. I'd love for someone to count the amount of times that Raf said customer there. I think that was pretty incredible to hear. If you'd like to see more from us behind the scenes, of course you can. You can go to the20minutevc.com. We love to see you there. But before we leave you today,
Mercury is building full stack banking for startups. Apply in under 10 minutes from anywhere for FDIC insured bank accounts, physical and virtual debit cards, domestic and international wires, and integrations with Gusto, Stripe, QuickBooks, Plaid, and basically every other tool your startup uses. They also offer unusual features like API access, custom team management, and their newly launched Mercury Treasury, a cash management product for high-growth startups. And they'll even help you build your startup with Mercury Raise, a program to connect you to Silicon Valley's top investors. Head to mercury.com/sign up to apply. And speaking of full-stack banking there with Mercury, I have to say I just love using the AngelList fund admin platform to manage my investments. The team and platform at AngelList takes care of all my back office needs so that I can really focus on working with great founders. Leading fund managers have made over 10,000 investments into 6,000 startups using AngelList, all online and all in one place. And with the recently announced rolling funds, you can easily find and invest in these top fund managers on angellist.com/rolling. And finally, you have to check out Masterworks, the first platform for buying and selling shares representing an investment in iconic artworks. Masterworks invite you to join an exclusive community investing in blue chip art, so you can invest in multi-million dollar paintings, buy and sell shares on secondary markets, and then receive the proceeds when the painting sells. With more than $150 million in paintings purchased, Masterworks is the top buyer in the art market. So build your diversified portfolio of expertly vetted works curated by industry-leading research with Masterworks, and you can find out more at masterworks.io.
As always, I so appreciate all your support, and I can't wait to bring you some more very special episodes.